I know something bad must have happened, she says quietly, her green eyes boring into mine. A mother doesn't just uproot her son from a small town and move out to the middle of nowhere if everything's happy. But whatever it was, she pauses, her fingers clasping mine, it wasn't your fault. You were just a little boy. Whatever happened with your father or your mother, whatever they did, or whatever happened to them, you were just a child. It wasn't your fault. You know that, right? In a roundabout way, I do know that. It's not my fault that my father killed those girls, but the fact remains that they're dead. It's not my fault that the townsfolk of Millinocket were frightened of my mother and me, but we couldn't live there anymore. It's not my fault that my blood, my genes, are half porter, but it doesn't change the fact that my grandfather worried for the monster inside me. Whatever it is, tell me you know it's not your fault, she says, her sweet voice pleading. Not my fault. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change anything. I am who I am. Bryn's eyes narrow as they focus on mine. Her voice is soft when she asks, What happened to you, Cassidy? Would it be a relief to tell her? My father was a sociopath who killed a dozen women or more. I found out on my 8th birthday. He was tried and convicted and killed in prison 10 months later by a group of angry inmates. It became unbearable for my mother and me to live in town, so we moved here. That's what happened to me. I look into her beautiful bright eyes that stare up at me with hope and compassion, and my heart swells with yearning to unload my tangled past. But I'm distracted by another emotion shining in her eyes. Something deeper and utterly impossible. Impossible even though I'm looking at it. Even though I'm seeing it stare back at me. Love. The deep and impossible emotion brightening Bryn's eyes is love. A jolt of realization makes my breath catch and my head swim. I jerk my hand away and take a step back from her, dropping her eyes and staring desperately down at my toes. We cannot love each other. It is not allowed. I can't.
You can't what?
She murmurs, still standing close to me. So close. I can't breathe. I can't do this. I can't love you. I can't let you love me.
It's okay,
she says, talking fast, an out-of-control quality entering into her rising tone.
We're adults. We're free. You're here, and me, alone, and we've been spending a lot of time together, and, you know that people who meet during traumatic experiences bond faster, so it makes sense that our feelings would grow into,
stop, I bark. The room goes still and somehow spins at the same time. My heart is pounding so loudly in my ears, I bet I'm wincing.
Cass,
she gasps. No, I bite out, just stop, please.
I'm sorry,
she says, and it's like someone reaches into my chest and fists my heart, a single bereft sound that makes me want to die because it is full of so much sadness, so much longing.
I thought...
Her voice drifts off. I clear my throat, then take a deep breath and hold it. Do something. Say something. Let's get those stitches out, I mutter, finally looking up at her. Her eyes are glistening because she's about to cry, which makes me feel like a demon. She tugs her top lip between her teeth, gnawing on it for a second before turning her back to me and taking a seat at the table.
Okay,
she says, averting her eyes, her voice defeated. I reach over the fridge for the first aid box and place it on the table. Without looking at her, I open it and take out a small scissors that I sterilized after using them last time, and a pair of tweezers.
Should I take off my shirt?
Yes. No. Definitely no. No, I say, pulling out the bottle of alcohol and a clean gauze pad. Just lift it a little. Her fingers drop to the hem and she pulls up the shirt, still looking away from me. When I glance at her face, she's blinking rapidly, her jaw clenched tightly, like she's desperately trying not to cry. Bryn, I say, pulling out the chair beside her and sitting down. I'm sorry for yelling. I don't look at her face. I focus on the first of the 6 incisions, swabbing it with alcohol first, then leaning forward to carefully cut through the middle of each stitch with the small scissors.
I feel like an idiot, she says, sniffling softly.
Snip, 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 snip. Don't, I say, resting the scissors on the gauze pad.
I thought we were...
I tug the stitches from each side with the tweezers, placing each half on the table. The small pile grows as I tug on the 10th knot, relieved when it slides easily from the tiny needle hole. I reach for the Steri-Strip and rip off 3 small pieces, which I place over the healing incision. What? I ask, moving to the next incision and swabbing it clean before cutting.
I thought you liked me.
I gulp, taking a deep breath as I pick up the scissors again. I do.
But not like that, she says.
I'm not totally sure what she means, but I assume she's talking about attraction, and she has no idea how very wrong she is. Snip, snip, snip. It's not a matter of liking you. It would be impossible not to like you, I say honestly, finding it far easier to talk about this when I'm concentrating on something other than her eyes. I reach for the tweezers. But we're very different.
How?
Well, for one thing, my life is here. Yours is in California.
Lives can change, she says.
Not that much. My life works. I'm not looking to change it. The second half of the 3rd stitch doesn't want to come out, and when I force it, she bleeds a little. I take a clean gauze pad and press it to a bright red blood droplet. Hold this. She is holding up her shirt with one hand and can't see what I'm doing, so I reach for her fingers and guide them to the gauze, pressing them gently. My fingers linger over hers for a moment before I pull away. I can take care of 1 more incision from this angle and get to work. It's the one that became infected last week, but now it looks good. It's healing well. Snip, 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 snip.
So you do like me,
she says, her voice less upset than it was before. Of course, I answer softly.
And we're trapped here together for 2 more weeks?
Mm-hmm, I murmur, tugging on another stitch, grateful when it slides out without bleeding. I release the tweezers and add the tiny knot to the pile.
What if...
That's 3, I say, interrupting her. Can you turn a little on the seat? Put your back to me? She follows my instructions, giving me her back, which I believe emboldens her to state.
14 days.
What?
We have 14 days together.
My heart thunders, and I focus on keeping my hands from shaking.
Today is July 6th, she says, her voice soft and nervous. I'll leave on July 20th, no matter what. I won't ask anything of you, Cass. I won't try to change your life. I won't try to stay. I won't ask you to go. I'll never come back, if that's what you want. I promise, I just...
Snip, snip, snip. I swallow, not daring to say a word, desperately wanting to hear the rest of what she has to say, but fearing that it will be too wonderful to refuse, even though I should.
And, if feelings bother you... We can take them out of the equation. No feelings. No declarations. We like each other. That's enough for me.
She says softly, her voice a little brave and a little sad as she finishes. I pick up the tweezers and she takes my silence as permission to continue.
But for the next 2 weeks we could, enjoy each other? All of each other?
Snip, snip, snip. Snip. I don't realize I've been holding my breath until I exhale. My hot breath streaks across her exposed skin. The tiny blonde hairs on her hips stand up, and I stare at them for a moment, blinking with growing realization. Although I've never been with a woman, my mind skates easily back to those old beat-up magazines lying under my mattress. I may not know much, but I know what she's suggesting. She's temporarily offering me her body in exchange for mine. I don't know exactly to what extent, but I'm fairly certain she's offering me sex. I know that it might be the only chance I ever get to experience what she's suggesting, and my blood surges, my body hardening everywhere at the idea. She's come dangerously close to offering me something I might actually be able to accept, no strings attached physical intimacy with an expiration date. No commitment, no marriage or children or forever, no chance of infecting the world with my father's genes. Without realizing it, she's giving me the opportunity to love her without breaking my promises. Snip, 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 snip. I cut through the last of her stitches, then place the scissors on the table. "Do you understand what I'm saying?" she asks, her back to me, her voice breathless and low. "Do you understand what I want? What I'm suggesting?" "Mm-hmm," I hum, surprised I'm able to make any sound at all. "Is that something you want, too?" I pull out the last of the stitches, then place the tweezers beside the scissors on the table, grazing her bare hip with my wrist as I withdraw it. I stare at her ponytail at the back of her neck, my eyes sliding down her bunched shirt and resting on her skin. It's white and soft over the waistband of her shorts, and I know if I say yes, I will have the right to touch it, to learn the contours of her body, to love her, maybe enough to last me a lifetime. She exhales, saying my name as her breath passes through her lips.
"Cass, please answer."
My heart pounds. I suck in a breath and hold it for what feels like eternity. "Yes," I hear myself answer, letting my forehead drop to the back of her neck in surrender. "I want it too."
Chapter 23. Bryn. I want it too. In an instant, my world has color like it's never had before. I don't know where my proposition came from, other than the fact that my longing for him, my base desire for him, has been bubbling up for days and won't be denied anymore. I lied to him when I said that we would take feelings out of the equation because I am already falling in love with him. But I am willing to keep those feelings to myself if it means we will belong to each other physically for the next 2 weeks. I will love him through the way that I touch him and kiss him and speak to him, but I will force myself not to say it, no matter how strongly I feel it. And how will I leave him at the end, after I know the warmth of his body covering mine, the heat of him between my thighs, the way his breath will catch when I arch against him, my inmost muscles sheathing his hardness like a glove for the very first time in his life? I don't know. But I will. I will because I promised. I will because I want this more than I dread our inevitable goodbye. And I will because I have a feeling he will insist on it. I want it too. I have no idea how this will work or when it will actually start. What if he reaches for me right this second and carries me to his bed, tells me to strip so he can bury himself inside me? Am I ready? Because I've talked a pretty big fucking game at this point, and he's agreed to play. I am so nervous with him sitting behind me, I can barely breathe. I feel the strength of him, the heat of his forehead against my neck as I drop the hem of my shirt and let it fall over my taped wounds. I am aware of every breath I take, of the way my breasts rise and fall, following the fullness and emptiness of my lungs. I am aware of his breathing, too. It's short and shallow and choppy against the back of my throat and makes me dizzy. He wants me as much as I want him. Please let it be enough.
We could.
His voice is gravel, husky and low, and I close my eyes, waiting to hear his suggestion. Part of me afraid, though I will do whatever he asks.
Watch that movie now, if you want.
A short laugh escapes my lips. It's a relieved and joyful sound. As much as I want Cassidy, maybe I'm not ready to jump into bed with him tonight. I need a little wooing, it turns out, regardless of my bold words. Yes, I say, laughing again as he lifts his head and I peek at him over my shoulder. His eyes are dark and he licks his lips, but if I'm not mistaken, there's a little smile tugging at the corners.
The Sandlot, right?
I nod. Uh-huh. Yeah, sounds good.
How about, you make us some popcorn while I get it set up?
Popcorn? Really?
Don't people still eat popcorn when they watch a movie?
Of course, I say, realizing that this is something he probably remembers from his short time living in town. He gestures to the cabinet over the sink with a flick of his chin.
And there's kernels, oil, and salt in there.
Okay. His eyes linger on my lips for one more second before he stands up, leaning over the table to tidy his first aid supplies and gather the leftover stitches into a pile, which he takes to the garbage. Still reeling from our conversation and wondering how our agreement will play out, I take a pot and cover the bottom with a thin coat of olive oil. I place it on the stove, ignite the burner, and throw two kernels into the bottom of the pot, waiting for them to pop. Behind me, in the living room, Cassidy is sitting on the couch, loading batteries into the VHS player for our movie night. For the most part, I've let the men in my life do the pursuing, so tonight I'm in uncharted territory. I guess I knew, or sensed, that if I didn't break open the conversation, it might not happen, and not being physical with Cassidy made me feel so desperate, so hollow, I knew I'd regret it for the rest of my life. Over the decades ahead, without him, I'd remember these days with him, and I'd grieve not having lived them to the fullest. The kernels pop, and I add two more handfuls of corn to the crackling oil, covering the pot with a lid and listening to the rat-a-tat-tat of the corn.
"Ready when you are,"
calls Cassidy, who is sitting on the couch, hunched over our makeshift cinema. "Two more minutes," I say, feeling a rush of excitement and nerves, which makes my stomach flutter with anticipation as if I were a teenager on her first date. And then it occurs to me that, for Cassidy, tonight is his first date. As the last of the kernels pop, I marvel at this fact, embracing it, silently promising to make it the best first date that any 27-year-old guy ever had. I pour the popcorn into a bowl, turn off the overhead kitchen light, and head into the living room, taking a seat on the couch beside Cass. I put the bowl between us because I figure whether a guy is in his mid-teens or mid-twenties, it's up to him to make the first move. It's not dark yet, but the sky behind Katahdin is streaked with lavender and purple, and without any other lights on, the glow from the small TV screen is bright and clear even though the movie is old and there's a bit of static on the top, no doubt from hundreds of viewings.
Ready?
He asks.
Yep. Okay, then.
He leans forward and presses the play button on the player, and the 20th Century Fox logo unfreezes as 90s-style synthesizer music accompanies a voiceover about the 1932 World Series and Babe Ruth's called shot. I've watched this movie a few times in my life. Along with Rudy and Miracle, it's one of my father's all-time favorites. And without a son with whom to watch his beloved sports movies, the job fell to me. Truth told, I loved a rainy afternoon watching movies with my dad, and I relax into Cassidy's couch as the movie flashes back to the 60s, showing a neighborhood baseball scene on the small screen. I'm so into the movie for the first 15 or 20 minutes, in fact, taking handfuls of popcorn on autopilot, that when my hand brushes against Cassidy's in the bowl, I'm jolted back to the reality of where I am. And with whom? My heart flutters as I yank my hand away. Sorry.
It's okay,
he says. And when I glance over at him, his lips are trembling in the bluish glow of the TV, like maybe he's trying not to laugh. What?
Are you nervous?
A little, I admit. He gives me side eyes.
Which one of us has never been on a date to the movies? You or me?
Don't overestimate me, I say. This all feels pretty new to me right about now.
Good,
he says, picking up the bowl and putting it on his left side so there's nothing between us anymore.
Because I have no idea what I'm doing.
He slides next to me until our hips are flush.
I've seen the yawn stretch arm around the shoulder move in other movies, you know. I guess I could give it a try.
Unless you're actually tired, I say, grinning up at him, you can skip the yawn. On one hand, I'm accustomed to him touching me. I mean, Cassidy and I have already been physically intimate to a certain degree. He carried me on his back. He's undressed me, bathed me, stitched me, and slept beside me. But this is different, and we both know it. This is deliberate. Any time we touch each other from now isn't about caregiving or comfort. It's about want. It's about need. It's about sex. So when he raises his arm and settles it around my shoulders, my breath hitches. And as the warm, heavy weight of his palm lands on my shoulder, I am so turned on suddenly. I wish we weren't at the beginning of the movie. Damn it, but I wish we were at the end. He squeezes just a little, pulling me closer, and I shift left on the nubby brown couch so that I'm leaning against him. I draw my feet up onto the cushion and put my head on his chest, just below his shoulder. When I glance up at him, he's completely focused on the movie, so I look back at the small screen, forcing myself to calm down and concentrate on the movie. And little by little, I do, until my heart's beating normally and my attention is focused on the story of a little boy who moves to a new neighborhood and makes friends playing baseball. Well, until the pool scene. As I realize what's coming, I'm hyper-aware of Cassidy sitting beside me. We're about to watch the scene where one of the boys fakes drowning so that the lifeguard he's crushing on will give him CPR and he can steal his first kiss.
I love this part,
he says, reaching for the popcorn bowl and offering it to me. No thanks, I whisper, staring at the TV, my entire body on high alert.
Do you remember your first kiss?
I nod. Of course.
When was it?
I was 14. He walked me home after a track meet.
And kissed you.
I realize that Cassidy's staring at me, his gaze searing as I continue to watch the movie. Mm-hmm.
They say you never forget your first kiss.
You don't, I murmur. My skin is flushing everywhere, and I can't hear the movie anymore. I can't concentrate on it. I can't concentrate on anything except for Cassidy beside me and what's about to happen between us.
Bryn,
he says.
Look at me.
I do. I turn my neck to look up at him, and his eyes are so wide and so dark they look black in the soft ambient light. They drop to my mouth, holding there for a long moment before sliding back up my face. He searches my eyes, as though giving me a final chance to push him away, then pulls me closer so that the tips of my breasts brush against his chest.
I'm calling my shot,
he says. I whimper softly, my lips parting in invitation. He looks back at my mouth, wetting his lips with his tongue, then leans closer, his nose brushing mine as he bends his head to claim my bottom lip between his. I close my eyes, arching my back to be closer to him as one of his hands reaches up to cup my jaw, his thumb under my ear, holding my face to his. His lips alternate between kissing my top, then bottom lip, claiming them each individually, sucking, kissing, stealing my breath as the arm around my waist holds me tighter. His lips depart, but his forehead rests on mine, and his nose nuzzles mine gently. I breathe him in, delirious with his taste and touch, with the smell of him, the almost unbridled strength of him. For a moment, I think we're done, but he surprises me by leaning forward and pressing his lips to mine again. I moan into his mouth, relieved because I want more. Gently, I swipe my tongue over his lips and feel him jolt against me, a low groan rumbling in his throat as his tongue slides against mine. The pressure of his thumb under my ear increases, his fingers curling into the base of my skull as I seal my lips over his, sliding onto his lap and threading my fingers into his hair. My knees dig into the couch on either side of his hips, and behind me I can hear the song "This Magic Moment" playing in the movie, which is the perfect soundtrack for what's happened between us. Deep inside, something that had almost given up on life knows for sure that it is completely, vibrantly alive again, and my heart laughs because I barely remember happiness like this. But it's here. And it's now, and it's Cassidy holding me in his arms and kissing me for the first time. His tongue dances with mine, touching, sliding, warm and wet, setting off fireworks inside me as I arch my breasts into his chest and feel his erection between us, hard and throbbing at the apex of my shorts, straining against his jeans. We should stop. I know we should stop because this is his first experience with a woman, and this kiss has gone much farther than most first kisses go. But we're not kids walking home from a track meet. He's a man, and I'm a woman, and every cell in my body screams for more of him. So I kiss him some more, swallowing his groans of pleasure, the hairs on my arm at attention when he growls into my mouth, his hands dropping to my ass and pushing my groin flush against his hardness. And finally, when we've missed 20 minutes of the movie, I wrap my arms around his neck and slide my cheek against his until my forehead rests in the curve of his collarbone. His breathing is fierce and choppy in my ear, and I smile as tears well in my eyes. My last kiss for so long was with Jem. Now my last kiss belongs to Cassidy. His arms move to clasp me against him, and he holds me as we catch our breath, our hearts flush and pounding relentlessly.
Bryn,
he murmurs, his breath kissing my throat. I laugh softly, pressing my lips to his neck before leaning up to look into his eyes. They are spellbound and tender, aching with something so beautiful, so inexplicable, all I can do is stare back. All I can hope is that he looks at me like this every day for the next 2 weeks, so that when I am back in my lonely home, I remember what it felt like to be loved by Cassidy. Now you've had your first kiss, I say, grinning at his slick, pouty lips.
And I'll never forget it, he says.
But his tone is different from mine, less playful, more like a vow, like he's promising me something important. Suddenly my self-consciousness kicks in as I realize I'm straddling his lap, pressing my breasts against his chest with rock-hard, beaded nipples digging into his abs. I lean to the left and let gravity pull my leg back over, sitting back on the couch and settling into his side where I was watching the movie before we got carried away. "Are you sleeping in my bed tonight?" I ask him as I stare at the screen.
"No."
I whip my neck to look up at him, and he glances down at me, gesturing to the prominent bulge under the zipper of his jeans.
"I've got no self-control with you, Bryn. I want everything now."
I'm about to tell him that's fine with me when he continues speaking.
"But I'm not getting you pregnant, and I don't have protection."
Part of me is shocked that he knows about condoms. I don't know why, because I'm sure his mother or grandfather taught him the basics of sex ed, but still, it surprises me that he should be so thoughtful. "You could pull out," I suggest, instantly embarrassed by the words because they sound so desperate in my ears.
No,
he says, shaking his head and looking away from me, back at the movie. His jaw is tight and his face is drawn, like he's angry with me or in some serious discomfort.
That's not an option.
I nod, wanting to respect his decision, regardless of the ache between my legs. I could feel him pressing against me, thick and hard, when I was straddling him. The practical side of my brain reminds me that I haven't been with anyone since Jem, and what's waiting for me behind Cassidy's zipper didn't feel average size. Maybe a few days to get better acquainted isn't such a bad idea after all. Still, I feel a little deprived, and I cross my arms over my chest and huff out a breath as we sit side by side, hot and bothered, pretending to watch the movie.
Bryn.
Hmm?
I said I wasn't going to sleep with you tonight.
I heard you.
But Angel...
I look up at him, because the way he calls me Angel makes me want to die a little. It's so reverent and tender. What?
I plan on kissing you until this movie's over.
My mouth opens to an O, and I stare at him as he slips his hands under my arms and pulls me back onto his lap, cradling me there.
Any objections?
He asks, locking his eyes with mine as his lips draw closer. None, I sigh, letting my Cass have his way with me.
Chapter 24. Cassidy. Whatever I thought it would be like to kiss a woman, it's all been blown to bits with two nights of Bryn straddling my lap on the couch while we devour each other's mouths, our bodies pressed close and our breath mingling. She belongs to me in ways now that I couldn't possibly fathom. She owns a part of me that is already gone, that I can never ever reclaim again. Exploring the sweet, soft recesses of her mouth while her fingers curl into my scalp, I have claimed her and surrendered to her at once. Everything is Bryn, and I am addicted to everything. She is air and water, smiles and soft sighs as she falls asleep in my arms. She is heat and warmth. She is promise and hope. She is normalcy and company and my temporary talisman against loneliness. She moves like the air or the dark surrounding me, inside me, of the world and yet belonging intimately and particularly to me. She is everything I want that I can't have, more and more necessary for survival, which means it will destroy me when I let her go. I know this, and yet I cannot slow down or take less. I love her. I will love her until the sky falls, until the sun and moon fail to rise, until Katahdin crumbles. I will love her forever. She grins at me over her shoulder as she collects eggs from the girls, and though I am milking Annie, it occurs to me to leap over the stool I'm sitting on and grab her around the waist, hauling her against my body to kiss her until she's limp and sighing. When she smiles, even I, damned from my very conception, cursed from the cradle, feel my heart soar. That's how it is with angels, I'm learning. I bet the devil couldn't stay away if he tried. I watch her. I memorize her. I drink her in, the way her dark hair caresses her cheek until she sweeps it behind her ear, the way her eyes sparkle when she peeks up at me and giggles, the way her breasts rise and fall with every breath she takes, her bare feet crackle softly on the hay that covers the hard wooden floor of the barn, and I am drawn even to them, in love with them, jealous of them, hating them a little because they will take her away from me. Except I can't hate her or anything about her. I would die to keep one of those toes safe. My broken Bryn, in pieces when I found her, seems to be more and more whole every day, and I fall harder and deeper for this sweet, gentle woman every moment I spend with her. What? Huh? I mutter, grinning at her because I am a man in love, foolish with tenderness, unable to help himself. You're just staring at me like crazy. I tug on Annie's teat, and a stream of milk spits into my metal bucket. Maybe 'cause I'm crazy about you, Angel. She freezes, and her eyes widen as she stares at me. You are? I give her a look. You know I am.
Then why can't we?
She's about to ask me why our days together must be finite, but she catches herself before the words leave her mouth. Over the past 2 days, my brain has more than once wanted to push our agreed-on boundaries to include a discussion of our feelings for each other, or an extension on our time together. But she has stopped herself every time. I clench my jaw, telling myself that I shouldn't lead her on with statements like, "I'm crazy about you," no matter how right they feel falling from my lips. We have agreed to a physical relationship with each other. Nothing else.
Are you still going to the store tomorrow?
She asks, her cheeks pinkening as she finds an egg under Stacy and places it gingerly in the wire basket. The store. The store where I will buy a box of condoms for the rest of our time together. Yeah, I say, my voice tight as I stand up abruptly, eliciting an annoyed "ma" from Annie. Sex. Aside from Bryn, it's all I think about lately. When we finally untangle our fully clothed bodies from each other every night, heading to our separate rooms, my body aches for hers so painfully. I've had to get myself off outside under a freezing cold midnight shower. It barely helps, though. My entire being is a magnet drawn to hers, and nothing will feed the hunger until I am buried inside her. Twice since the Sandlot, I've looked at the pictures in my magazines, not to appease my longing or slake my thirst, but because I want to be sure I understand what to do. I can't lie. I'm nervous about my lack of experience, and the bounty of hers. I can't promise that I'll be smooth when we finally make love, but damn it, I want to get it as right as possible. For her, and frankly, for me, so that when she compares me with other men years and years from now, I will have some small chance of holding my own in her memories. It's wrong, I know, but I am desperate that she remember me. Sometimes it's the only thought that gives me strength when contemplating my lonely future, that after the time we've spent together, I will always be a part of her.
You know,
she says, her voice warm and flirtatious, as she leans her elbows on the split rail that separates Annie's stall from the girl's coop.
We should have a picnic at the pond today.
Yeah? She nods, a smile, possibly a little forced, brightening her beautiful face.
Doesn't that sound nice? Sunshine, warm day, soft blanket? Willing woman?
Willing woman. She's going to kill me. I put my hands on the rail on either side of her elbows. Do you swim, Ms. Cadogan?
Swim? Of course.
You've been complaining about your hair for a few days now, I say, so close to her that I could drop my lips to hers. How about you let me wash it? She gasps, her eyes widening.
Cass, I'd give anything.
Anything? I grind out.
Anything but...
Her lips close, but lightly, and she tilts her head.
Don't you see? Everything's already yours.
Kill me dead. I reach for her cheeks, cupping her face as I find her lips with mine. It's not that I'm used to the taste and texture of them, but she is familiar to me now, and I sink into the feeling of her, irritated by the fence between us. Instinctively, I want to feel the heat of her body pressed against mine as my tongue tangles with hers. She moans, and the sound shoots straight to my groin, where my pecker swells with a rush of blood, hardening in my jeans. I try to pull her closer but can't, and finally I break off the kiss out of frustration. The pond, I pant. She nods, her green eyes black.
The pond.
As we walk through the meadow to the pond holding hands, I think about what I found in the back of my closet while looking for the swim trunks I haven't used in years. It's a camera, my mother's old Polaroid, and it has 3 pictures left inside. I put it in the bottom of a bag holding a blanket, 2 towels, and a bottle of shampoo, and now I'm wondering how smart an idea that was. I mean, of course I want a picture of Bryn, but will that picture drive me to madness once she's gone? Wouldn't it be better just to live on faded memories?
Your mom was smaller than me.
The sun is high in the sky, and the tall grasses sway in a lazy afternoon breeze as Bryn looks up at me. Huh? I glance down at her, wearing my mother's old navy blue bathing suit and a pair of denim shorts. The stretchy material strains over her breasts, dipping so low it barely covers her nipples. It's a good thing we're all alone out here, I think, because what's under that suit is mine, and I wouldn't want another man ogling her. Up top, says Bryn, patting her chest with a free palm. She was smaller than me. Yeah, I nod. She was tiny. Was she sick for a long time? I think back to the way she kept to her bed more and more, always tired, that worried look in her eyes increasing as the months went on. For about a year. It went fast. Did you take care of her? Gramp and I both did. She never stayed at a hospital? No. She went to a doctor toward the end, but it was too late to do much for her by then. Cancer, right? I nod. How did your dad... Almost there, I say, cutting her off. Did I mention I found a camera? What? A camera? You did? Uh-huh, I say, squeezing her hand, grateful her attention's been diverted. An old Polaroid. Ha, they're back in style now, you know. Really? Yeah, teens love them. They're smaller now and come in all different colors, but yeah, they're really popular. Everything old becomes new again, doesn't it? I wouldn't know. Everything old just... is. There's not much film left in it, I say. Enough for a selfie? A selfie? You know, she says, grinning up at me. We put our cheeks together, hold the camera away from our faces, smile, and click. Voila! A selfie, I say, nodding now that I understand. Yeah, I guess we do. There are three pictures left. One of Cass, one of Bryn, one selfie, she says in a sing-song voice. Bryn has a pretty voice. Once or twice while I was playing the Beatles on Graham's old guitar, she'd hum along, and I tried to sing softer so I could hear her. We could have a campfire tomorrow night, I suggest. I'll get out my guitar. Sounds good. Will you sing? She nods. If you play the Beatles, I will. Then I'll play the Beatles, I say as we clear the woods and find ourselves at Harrington Pond. Why don't we spread out the blanket on your rock? My rock? She says, smiling up at me, squinting her eyes at the sun. I kiss her sweet lips once, twice, three times before kissing the tip of her nose. Bryn's rock. Bryn's Cass, she murmurs, her voice husky, her lips moving against my cheek. The two simple words make something inside me clench hard, and it's almost painful, like a swift kick to the gut. Not for long. Not for long. Yeah, I mumble. I drop her hand and walk through the tall grass, over to the large flat rock. I spread out Mama's favorite red plaid wool blanket. Want to have lunch first? She lifts the picnic basket and hands it to me. No. Not hungry. Since you mentioned washing my hair this morning, I can barely think about anything else. Please? She sighs with longing, and my pecker jumps in my swim trunks. Yeah, I say, turning back to the bag to take out the shampoo. Let's wash it. When I turn around, she's pulling Mama's shorts down her creamy white legs. She steps out of them and throws them to me. Last one in is a rotten egg. Giggling, she runs into the pond, jumping in and submerging her head almost immediately, though I know it's got to be cold. Glacier-made ponds in northern Maine are rarely warm, even in July. When her head bobs up, she's gasping but still laughing. I reach behind my neck and tug my T-shirt over my head, then, holding the bottle of shampoo in my hand, I jump from the rock into the pond. It's cold as heck, but refreshing on such a sunny day. And I rise to the surface laughing, just like Bryn. From where we are, still relatively close to the shore, we can both stand. I hold up the bottle. Ready? Droplets of water cling to her lashes as she walks toward me. Bottom's squishy. Turning away, she backs up against me, no doubt feeling the push of my erection in her back. I can't help feeling turned on. She's practically naked, and I'm about to touch her. Oh, she hums, her voice merry as she rubs her bottom against me. Someone's not very affected by the cold. I clench my jaw, put one hand on her shoulder to make her stop. You want your hair washed or not? She giggles again, taking a step forward so I'm no longer fondling her back with my jutting length. Yes, Cassidy, I want my hair washed. I pour shampoo into my hand, tuck the bottle under my arm, then reach for her scalp, working the soap into a small lather. She leans her head back, moaning softly. I put another handful of soap into my palms and rub it into her hair, taking care to pull it through the strands, gently digging my fingers into her scalp and behind her ears. Cass, she hums, her eyes closed, her face drinking in the sun. I pull the bottle from under my arm and toss it onto the shore. Then I go back to work, gathering her dark hair in my hands and massaging her scalp with my fingers. Mmm, she sighs, the soft moan of pleasure competing with a gentle ripple of water and the summer song of the cicadas. I lean down close to her ear and murmur, time to rinse. She leans back, her neck straining, and I guide her head into the water, running my fingers through the clean hair from her forehead to the tips, then back again. There's something incredibly intimate about servicing her like this, knowing that her gasps and moans of pleasure are because of me, that I am bringing that sort of satisfaction to her. Knowing that I can pleasure her makes me feel a little godlike, frankly, because she is my angel, the closest thing to heaven I have ever encountered. The last of the soap floats away, and she leans up slowly, finally standing in front of me, her back to my chest. I watch, holding my breath, as she skims her hands up to her shoulders. She hooks her fingers under the straps of the bathing suit, then slides them down her arms, over her elbows, pulling her hands through the openings, first one, then the other. The suit is peeled down to her waist, hidden under the water, leaving her back naked to me. She reaches behind, feeling through the water to find my hands at my sides. Taking them in hers, she steps back, her lower back flush against my throbbing erection. My breath catches as she leans her head on my chest, then raises my hands to her breasts, covering her flesh with my palms. Her nipples are hard, like little pebbles covered in velvet, and I move my hands experimentally, cupping the soft, wet mounds of sweet flesh as she closes her eyes and exhales on a soft moan. Her breath is ragged and choppy as she reaches up with one arm to pull my head down to hers. But when she leans up and our lips connect, she steals all my breath to fill her lungs. Turning slowly in my arms until her chest presses against mine, she kisses me hungrily. I slide my hands down her wet skin, over the bunched-up fabric of her bathing suit to her backside, lifting her up. As she does on the couch every night, she straddles my waist, locking her feet above my hip bone and cradling my hard length between her thighs. The stiff points of her naked breasts rub against my chest as she winds her arms around my neck and holds on. My penis throbs between us, pressure building as she arches against me, moving her hips rhythmically against my arousal, the silken slide of her warm, wet tongue unbelievably erotic against mine. Every nerve ending in my body is firing as this sweet woman moans into my mouth, and suddenly I can't hold back anymore. I let go. My orgasm rocks through my body, making me growl and release as I clasp her against me, as ribbons of my hot release jet from my body in spurts, gathering in my swim trunks. I am shuddering against her even as I hold her, and she nuzzles my face tenderly. Good? She asks softly. So good, I answer, the last of my shudders fading. I open my eyes to find her smiling at me. Sleep in my bed tonight? She asks. I shake my head. If anything, what just happened is proof that I have zero control around her. I won't risk it. I can't. Tomorrow. She unclasps her feet from my waist and lowers them back to the pond bottom, looking up at me, her green eyes deep and lovely, if a little disappointed. Thank you for washing my hair. Thank you for... My eyes drop to her breasts, and though I peeked at them a couple of weeks ago, now I stare at them hungrily, with permission, without shame. They are full and pert, with pink nipples that beckon to me. I want to taste them, to kiss them like I do her lips. Lowering my head, I cup the right breast, plumping it between my hands, then dip my lips to taste her. Her skin is warm from the sun, but cool from the lake, and the already hardened nipple puckers between my lips. I lave it with my tongue, letting instinct take over as she plunges her hands into my hair, drawing me closer with a gasp and groan. Swirling my tongue around the erect bud, I run my thumb back and forth over its twin, before skimming my lips across her chest and sucking it into my mouth, too. "Cass," she cries softly. I experiment with a little more pressure, sucking greedily, and she whimpers sharply, pushing my head away. I rest my forehead in the curve of her neck, opening my eyes, not certain if I've done something wrong. "No more," she murmurs, out of breath, her pulse hammering in her throat. She forces my head up and kisses my lips, then speaks against them. "It can be too much." "Bad?" I whisper, frozen, worried that I might have hurt her. "No, love. Wonderful," she says, drawing back to look up at me. Her lips are puffy from kissing, and her eyes are dilated and wide. I don't know if she's ever looked so beautiful. "But I want more." "Ah, this I understand." "Tomorrow," I say.
"Tomorrow."
With a nod of her head, she gestures to our blanket on the rock as she pulls up the straps of the bathing suit, covering herself.
"Hungry?"
"Always, Bryn. Always." As though reading my mind, she shakes her head and grins at me like I'm being naughty. I've never experienced this sort of flirting before, and I laugh at her expression because I love it. She takes my hand and pulls me back to shore. And I follow.
Chapter 25. Bryn. After yesterday's hot frolic in the pond, I felt Cassidy's hungry eyes on me for the rest of the afternoon, and today, over breakfast, too. As he drives away on his ATV after his morning chores, headed for the store, my heart grows tendrils unfurling toward him, straining to be with him even as the sound of the motor fades into the distance. Finally, I turn around and climb up the steps to sit on one of the three rockers on the front porch. Maybe I'll just rock here until he returns, and try to process everything going on between us. My mind is spinning. We want each other with a longing that's starting to border on desperation, and for the first time in my life, I'm wondering why there isn't a female counterpart of Blue Balls. I love the attention, of course. The way he makes me feel like the most delectable, desirable woman in creation, and I have certainly never wanted a man so much in my entire life as I want Cassidy Porter. That said, my poor heart is counting down the days. With only 10 left, I'm not sure how I can bear it. Losing Jem almost broke me, but Jem is gone, and there's no way he'll ever be back. He isn't alive somewhere on the earth living his life without me. He isn't an option, and making my life a shrine to him isn't what he would have wanted. It isn't what I want either. I want to live, and I want love. I want Cassidy. When I leave him in a week and a half, in the back of my mind, I'll know that he's alive. He's living and breathing somewhere on the earth without me. Without me. Little by little, day by day, that's what will break me, knowing he's out there, alive and well, and I can't have him. And why not? Why can't I have him? I push off from the floor, rocking the chair angrily and thinking back to the two times that Cassidy has ever yelled at me. The first was when we were reading on the couch and I asked him if he was lonely, if he wanted a girlfriend or a wife. His answer hadn't been ambiguous, nor did it leave room for interpretation. "I'm just not much of a people person, I guess," he said, and when I pressed, he snapped at me. "I don't need anyone." My mind segues to our conversation in the kitchen when he removed my stitches. Not unlike the other time, he totally shut down when I tried to talk about feelings, yelling at me to stop. Later in the conversation, he made it clear that although he liked me, he wasn't interested in changing his life, that he liked his life the way it was. Essentially the same sentiment he'd shared before. It's a hot button, for sure, Cassidy allowing someone into his life. We can't even talk about it without him yelling at me and shutting down. And that vehemence should convince me he's telling the truth. Right? Except it doesn't. Because I've always believed that actions speak louder than words, and Cassidy's actions speak about him caring for me, enjoying me, maybe even starting to love me a little. He claims to feel one way about his solitary life, but he sinks into my company, seeking out my presence, spending all his time with me, holding me like I'm the most precious person in his world. So I'm confused by the disconnect. He says he doesn't need anyone, doesn't want anyone, but it seems like, it feels like he needs and wants, well, me. I keep rocking, the movement soothing and good for thinking. Why would he say something that wasn't true? Why must I leave when I am well and able? Why can't we be together for a little longer? Or a lot longer, if that's what we want? I can't help but wonder if his reluctance to be with me, or indeed to change his life, has something to do with why he and his mother left the town and moved out here in the first place. Frustrated that I don't have access to the internet, where I could surf their names, birth records, death records, and newspaper articles, I decide to get a little old-fashioned. Maybe I can piece together Cassidy's history a different way. There's got to be something inside the cabin that could tell me why he and his mother left town, why he chooses to live this lonely existence so far from humanity. I head into the house. He won't be back for a few hours, so I beeline to his room at the end of the hall. It's small and tidy, with a twin bed, a nightstand, a bureau, a closet, and a door to the outside. I lean down, opening the first drawer of his bureau, then the second, then the third. But even when I carefully push around his neatly folded clothes, I don't find anything hidden in the backs of the drawers. Turning to his closet, I realize that I can't reach the top shelf, so I get a chair from the kitchen and drag it back to his room. I step up on it and look at the top shelf, where, presumably, he found his mother's Polaroid camera. There are winter clothes, a neatly folded parka and snow pants, plus all manner of gloves, mittens, and hats, in a plastic laundry basket. Feeling around behind the clothes, I find nothing out of the ordinary, until my fingers touch a metal box. I pull it gently from the piles of clothes and carefully step down from the chair to take a better look. I sit on Cass's bed and open the top, peering down at the contents. On top is a folded piece of paper, which, when I unfold it, reveals a set of 4 photo booth pictures of a little boy and a 30-something woman, cheek to cheek and all smiles. I recognize Cassidy and his mother instantly and stare at his mom's kind blue eyes and frizzy blonde hair. She is homely. Her front teeth are badly bucked, and she doesn't wear any makeup, but her smile tells me how much she loves her son, and his smile tells me how much he loves her back. Setting the photo aside, I pluck a leather bracelet from the box and hold it up. Burned into the leather is the name Cassidy, uneven and jagged, like he made it by himself. Under the bracelet, I find another photo, this time of a little boy and a grown man standing side by side in a park about a foot from each other. The man, who is different from the man I saw in the portrait over the sofa, towers over the boy. He stares intently into the camera with his arms crossed over his chest. The little boy does the same, his mouth a flat, grim line. Neither looks especially happy or comfortable. I flip over the picture and read, Paul and Cass, Father-Son Cookout, 1995. Paul. His father. about whom he never speaks, who died when he was 9. I flip over the picture again and look at the man more carefully, the way he wears his hair slicked to the side and his heavy black-rimmed glasses.